Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for being here. Thank you for coming to participate in this dialogue, this engagement, this coming together, this understanding, our misunderstanding. But whatever the case might be, we are here, to listen, to talk, to open up, to create new possibilities. And you are part of that, and I'm a part of that. You know what we're doing? We're making history, and we're taking history, and we're saying that we are trying to make sure that in the Bay Area and in America and in the world, we will respond in ways that will lift us up and take us to new heights. There's no doubt about it. We've got real possibilities. And I want to personally, I'm Cecil Williams. If you don't know me by now, you will get to know me by the end of this program. But I want you to know that we are very thrilled that you're here and that you've come many places, from many places, to participate in this give and take. And that's what we want it to be, a give and take. But we are not here to point at people and to say you are worse than other folks. We're here to say we're all caught and gripped by a situation where we must open up new possibilities. We will come and create new possibilities. We'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club, and we'd like to thank those of you from other places and other disciplines. And we want you to know that you're at the right place at the right time doing the right stuff. So thank you very much. Welcome, 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 and keep welcoming. Thank you very much.
The mistake is to let him go first, because he pretty much said it all. Thank you for being here. Welcome. And we are so proud to co-sponsor this event with the Commonwealth Club. This is an extremely important issue. And, you know, historically, Glide has been, Cecil has been, we have been on the front lines with the issues around violence and dehumanization from communities that have been marginalized, the disenfranchised, the poor. So we started with the LGBTQ community and their issues with conflicts with the police department, and went on, of course, with the communities of color, the African-American communities, and we've struggled with many movements that have faced conflict with each other or with law enforcement. And as Cecil said, you know, GLIDE has been founded upon the values of unconditional love and acceptance and always our commitment to justice. So tonight we look forward to talking about justice. What does that mean? What does it mean to be accountable? What does it mean to be truthful? What does it mean to be really, really open in our dialogue about facing what the problems are? And how can we come to some solution? How can we overcome violence and hatred and come to a place of connection, bridging, and creating a more beloved community between all segments of our city as well as all of our communities? I just want to acknowledge GLIDE leadership. Rita Shimon is our executive director. James Lynn, Rita, stand up, stand up. James Lynn, who is the director of our Social Justice Center, who's worked closely with the Commonwealth Club. Thank you. Again, welcome, and I'm turning this over to Marissa Levine.
Thank you, Reverend Williams and Ms. Mirakatani and the entire GLIDE community for inviting the Commonwealth Club of California to produce this event, Policing the Police, together. My name is Marissa Levine, and I'm a member of the program production team here at the Commonwealth Club. At the club, which is for now actually a neighbor of GLIDE's, just up around the corner on Post Street, we produce hundreds of events every year, from politics to pop culture. At the beginning of 2017, the club will be moving down near the Ferry Building at 110 The Embarcadero, and for the very first time in our 113-year history, we will have our very own home. So we look forward to seeing those of you who might be new to a Commonwealth Club event at future programs. Be sure to take one of the flyers on your way out tonight. Just one example of another program we'd love to see you at. Tomorrow, we will be hosting Paulette Brown, the new president of the American Bar Association. As we are busy breaking down glass ceilings this summer, Ms. Brown is one of a handful of women who have been at the helm of the ABA and is the first African-American woman to do so. She's a legal expert on diversity and inclusion and will be talking about how to make the justice system more just. Now, for those of you in the audience tonight, we are giving away some free tickets to that program. To access those, visit commonwealthclub.org/free, and you will see a ticket type called community. So we'd love to see you there. Now, tonight, we hope that you either write down your questions on some of the cards that will be on the pews next to you, the little white cards, if anybody wants to hold one up. See you there, sir, with one of those. And our volunteers will be circulating to collect those from you tonight, so you can start writing them down at any time. We'll also be accepting your questions on Facebook and Twitter. We are at CW Club. Glide is at Glide SF. And you'll actually see all of the Twitter handles for our panelists up on the screen during the program. Please, though, make sure your cell phones are off. Your cell phones are on silent, rather. We also wish to remind everyone that the Commonwealth Club and Glide are nonpartisan organizations, and we do ask that our speakers be allowed to make their remarks tonight without interruption. We've also got a really full house tonight for this community conversation, so scooch in really close, so that when people are coming in late, because it's San Francisco, they'll have a seat that they can get to. Yeah, I know. So when Youth Speaks poet Azaria Cole Shepherd comes out on stage shortly, I hope you give her an incredibly warm Commonwealth Club and Glide welcome.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Azaria Cole Shepherd. I am 18. I am from Oakland, California, and I'm a freshman at San Jose State University. I am here on behalf of the Oakland Youth Poet Laureate Program and Youth Speaks as the 2016 Oakland Youth Poet Laureate. For the black men my love cannot protect, you are radiant. Your eloquence is the gun they swear you have when they shoot you. The speed of your tongue, a justification to stand their ground. Your existence is the antithesis of their contentment. For this world is not prepared for your potential to succeed. You are powerful. I wrote BART today. As I passed Fruitvale Station, my heart dropped. I thought about Oscar and the bonding his baby girl will never experience at the hands of the bondage that took him forever. I thought about the gun and taser clothing, synonymous for the oops that follows genocide, dear black man. Your stark white smile shines like the stars and your lips curve like the crescent moon. But every time I see the night sky that is your face, the fear grows inside. You see, they shot Mike and Trayvon and Allen and Mario and Tamir and Eric and Alton and Alva and Paul and Phil. They even choked Eric, and I don't want to know what they will do to you. As the bullet penetrates this tissue, I will buy stock in tissue because these tears won't stop. And I know your tomorrow ain't promised. So today I tell you I love you. I feel that you don't hear it enough. Baby mamas and MTV and even BET saying you are inadequate, but you are enough. So as you pour yourself out like libations for those you have loved and lost, black man, remember you need to stand tall. They said that there was no warmth like the warmth of a mother's arms, her love, a burning passion for your survival. But what does that warmth do for the cold body she caresses? She no longer wears white dresses, then bloodstains don't come out. The bleach didn't burn her skin just like the system didn't burn us, and they dare ask, are you a respectable Negro? Are you pleasant enough to only leave a few bumps and bruises when they beat you, or are you a beast? Will you break their bones like you break racial barriers and turn them against one another like stiff pages in books you have read? You are intelligent, but how exactly do you use the knowledge in your head to pass the bar whose weight we are crushing under as we wait for social change? Black men, take hold of your sisters, for this patriarchal society means us no good. When you make it to your 21st birthday, please celebrate to no end, for this is a major life event no other race will understand. Remind your sisters that they should stand tall. For we are not stepping stones towards liberation. We be the backbone that backs you up when nobody else got you, dear black man. I can continue to carve the words I love you into your skin with my eyes, but I traded my vessels for bullets I would take for you. My cries for chrome knuckles race to the sky and death for deconstruction of a system that don't want us here. So when you make it to the end of this year, you better remember this letter. For we can no longer count the number of fatalities, and I cannot claim your body in the morgue. My cold body may be the one laying right next to yours. They killed Tanisha and Sandra and Rakia and Miriam and Shelly and Diamond and Darnisha. Dang it, the list goes on, and I may be next, Black man, my love. What will it take to make them see your worth? I am mourning, and in the morning, I am scared you will not be here. Do you hear me, or have you silenced me like the rest of the community do? I mean, it's fine if you have. The only question that remains is, if I don't speak up for us, where does that leave you? Thank you.
Good evening. Hello, everybody. Can you hear me all right? Good. I'd like to welcome all of you to Glide Sanctuary, where we are this minute. My name is Cruz Reynoso, and I just want to welcome you on behalf of the Commonwealth Club and the Glide Center for Social Justice. We're grateful that you are here for this important and timely discussion about the state of policing in San Francisco and throughout the country. Our focus this evening is on the fair administration of justice, the premier civil rights issue of our time. The problem of racial bias in the law enforcement entered into our collective consciousness once again with the shooting, you'll recall, of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Next Tuesday will mark the 2-year anniversary of Michael Brown's death. Rather than bringing the communities together to chart a path forward to restore faith and trust in law enforcement, these last 2 years have been riddled with disturbing and highly publicized reports of questionable incidents of police use of force against people of color, many caught on videos, as we all know. More recently, the equally disturbance has been the recent rise of violence against police themselves. Here in San Francisco, arguably the most progressive city in America, we are not immune from this problem, from those tragedies, or from bias. In March 2015, the first of two racist and homophobic text messaging scandals rocked the San Francisco Police Department and shook the community's faith in its guardians. Following this revelation, District Attorney George Moscone convened the Blue Ribbon Panel in Transparency, Accountability, and Fairness in Law Enforcement to inquire into how racial and homophobic biases might affect our officers' interaction with the people of color and members of the LGBT community. Prosecutors aren't just tasked with putting people in jail. They have a constitutional mandate, responsibility to seek after justice. And let me repeat that. Prosecutors have a responsibility for justice. And that's why the district attorney set up this commission. And when he set it up, he told all of us that he wasn't giving us any instructions except the Constitution of the United States of America. Accordingly, at the heart of the Blue Ribbon Panel's analysis was the question, is there institutionalized and systemic bias within the San Francisco Police Department? I want to be clear from the very beginning of this discussion. The vast majority of police officers are excellent human beings. The problem we see across the country is often that police culture, practices, and accountability mechanisms don't always require excellence. And the implications for those who are policed can be severe. The Blue Ribbon Panel, on which I serve, and one of my colleagues is here also, was supported by the diligent work of 7 law firms and 5 law schools. And I want to emphasize that all of the work that has been done on a pro bono basis, even though hundreds and hundreds of hours have been spent by those law firms, by the jurors, and so on. We examined whether biased conduct was limited to the 14 officers involved in the TexGate scandal, or whether the San Francisco Police Department's culture and policies contributed to the problem. Over the course of a year, we interviewed more than 100 witnesses and received thousands of public documents. And last month, we issued an extensive report detailing all 72 of the findings, along with 81 recommendations. From our research, we found that in 2015, San Francisco police searched black and Hispanic people without their consent at higher rates than any other racial group. Of all the people searched without consent, though, black and Hispanics were the least likely to be found with contraband on them. Even more troubling, 36 of 51 suspects shot by police in San Francisco between 2010 and 2015, over 70% were black or Hispanic. In 18 officer-involved shootings during the same period, officers didn't even record the race of the deceased, and the data they did collect was recorded on paper only. Poor data management by the San Francisco Police Department has been a critical finding of the Blue Ribbon study. Not only does it reflect a failure to modernize, but it also comes at the cost of transparency. And transparency by any official is the most important thing that we as citizens require. In line with the theme of this discussion, policing and the police, and how we can reform America's law enforcement, one of our main recommendations is to create an Office of Inspector General to audit the San Francisco Police Department. In the Office of Citizens' Complaints, we found that there were just many gaps, if you will, between the citizens of this city and the work that was being done by those who have a responsibility to make sure that everything goes well with the police department. We also recommended updating the San Francisco Police Department policy to mandate minimal use of force. Together, all 81 of our recommendations aimed to make the San Francisco Police Department a more transparent, fair, and trusted institution. Although we developed our recommendations with a critical eye, we recognize that the San Francisco Police Department is far from alone in grappling with institutionalized bias. Cities across the country face the same problem. The difference is that San Francisco now has a roadmap to make us go forward. The troubling intersection of law enforcement and racial disparity, violence and injustice, is not a new phenomenon. It is indelibly linked to our origin as a nation. What we now know about implicit racial bias reveals the depth of this legacy. Only by systematically and comprehensively reforming our most powerful institutions will we be able to fix the problem. And I just want to say that I think it's the Board of Supervisors that are going to have that responsibility. And San Francisco has the opportunity to lead the nation in this effort. I, along with the Commonwealth Club and the GLIDE Center for Social Justice, want to thank you for joining us for this important discussion. Now, please welcome CNN Justice Reporter Scott Glover, who will introduce our panelists for us. Thank you very much.
First off, thank you to Youth Speaks poet Azaria Shepherd, Cole Shepherd, and Judge Cruz Reynoso, and to the generous folks here at GLIDE who have welcomed the Commonwealth Club of California and all of us to this beautiful sanctuary. The Commonwealth Club is teamed with GLIDE's Center for Social Justice to produce this program about reforming American law enforcement, policing the police. I'm Scott Glover. I'm an investigative journalist and justice reporter for CNN and your moderator for this evening's program. Prior to joining CNN last year, I worked at the LA Times for 18 years, where I did a lot of reporting with a colleague by the name of Matt Late, and we covered the LAPD and law enforcement issues there. I did it for about 18 years. Notably, we covered something that was called the Rampart Scandal that occurred back in 1999, and that was having to do with an anti-gang unit that was accused of unjustified shootings, beatings, planting drugs, and so on. And this went on for about a year or so. And my beat morphed into covering sort of the underbelly of law enforcement. We did a major project on officer-involved shootings, some 1,400 of them over a span of 17 years. We wrote a lot about suspicious in-custody deaths, et cetera. That's why I'm moderating this evening. I mention it to you now to provide context for some of the questions that I will ask later in the evening so you understand where they're coming from. We're here tonight in San Francisco, but we could be, maybe should be having this conversation in Minnesota, Baton Rouge, Ferguson, Baltimore, New York City, various places around the country. America is struggling with an increasing number of incidents where images are captured depicting controversial uses of force by police on predominantly black and brown members of the community. The culture within law enforcement departments from coast to coast is under fire. In some recent cases, quite literally. How can we create a more perfect union between police and the citizens they protect and encourage transparency, accountability, and fairness in law enforcement? The Commonwealth Club repeatedly asked Acting SFPD Chief Tony Chaplin to speak on this panel tonight, but his office said that the department is unable to participate in this panel due to scheduling concerns. I understand that there may be some police officers who are here in the audience this evening, and I would encourage them to make their views known or to ask questions and provide cards to the people who are circulating through the office, because their view is just as important as anyone else. And though I've written the things that I've written over the years, I am by no means anti-police. I think it's a crucial job in society. We're going to start this conversation about what happened here in San Francisco and the findings of the Blue Ribbon Panel on Transparency, Accountability, and Fairness in Law Enforcement that investigated what happened, and then move it across the country to talk about how we can implement some of those recommended changes. I'm grateful to be joined by George Gascon, SF District Attorney, who convened the Blue Ribbon Panel to investigate the San Francisco Police Department. He was the former chief of the San Francisco Police Department and served as a Los Angeles Police Department high-ranking official for many years and spent most of his career there. Ladoris Cordell is a retired judge of the Superior Court of California and a member of the Blue Ribbon Panel that investigated the SFPD. Judge Cordell was also the former independent police auditor for the city of San Jose. W. Kamau Bell is a host of the new CNN Emmy-nominated show, United Shades of America. He's also a host of a public radio show and an acclaimed political comedian. Van Jones, last but not least, is an author, attorney, and CNN political commentator. He has co-founded several nonprofit social justice organizations, including Cut 50 and Dream Corps. I'm sure it's abundantly clear by now that I'm not a polished TV guy and that I spent most of my years in print. So just bear with me as we proceed. I will direct my first question to District Attorney Gascon. The Blue Ribbon Panel report talks about a good old boy culture, an outdated disciplinary system that lacks transparency, and a system for backgrounding officers that is ripe with abuse and favoritism. To what extent did you recognize those problems during your tenure, and how did you attempt to address them? That's the first part of the question. And the second part is, as you sit here now, with the benefit of hindsight, how, if at all, would you do things differently?
First of all, I think it would be important for me to give you a little context as to who I am, because that will inform the conversation that we'll have during this evening. I was raised in a very poor community in Southeast L.A., born from an immigrant family, and I got to see firsthand good policing and bad policing, but quite frankly, as a young man, I saw more bad policing than good policing. I remember being stopped often when we were driving, having our cars searched, and very consistent with the findings that that our Blue Ribbon panel found. There was no narcotics or no contraband in my vehicle or my friends. But I also occasionally saw one of my friends maybe get a little out of hand because they were irate for the treatment and very quickly be dispatched with what is known as street justice. I became a police officer because I wanted to ensure that the communities that I police, certainly at least at my level, there would be a different treatment with respect and dignity of the people that we dealt with. And I grew up in the LAPD professionally. I worked most of my career in South LA. Many of you would know it as Watts or South Central LA and East LA. And I can tell you then my experiences as a police officer in recognizing that the majority of the people that I worked with were trying to do the right things, but there were a few that weren't. And I can give you one instance when I was working right after an incident came to be known in the LAPD as the Hollywood Burglars, where a group of officers were staging burglaries, primarily of businesses, and then they would go to take the report and they would steal merchandise before the owners of the business responded. And I remember, and this was very early on in my career, I worked for a short period of time in Hollywood, which had some affluent parts and some not so affluent, and going to take a burglary report at a home in a very affluent part of Hollywood, and realizing very quickly that the owner of the house was following me wherever I went, which was somewhat unusual as I was trying to do my investigation. And I turned around and I asked her, and she was very apologetic, but she says, "You know, officer, I'm very sorry, but I cannot trust you." And this was on the heels of the scandal becoming public. And what that told me very early on in my career is that what a few people do in law enforcement wrong can have a tremendous impact in the work of everyone else. So you fast forward now to where we are today, dealing with the problems of excessive force and the targeting of primarily minority men, especially African Americans, which, by the way, it's not new. It's only now being provided because everyone has a camera. And I can't help but reflect on the importance of creating police practice and a culture within police that is respectful, that is unbiased, that treats people with respect. And to the point that you ask, Scott, what should I have done differently? And looking back with the benefit of hindsight, what would I do differently moving forward? I have to tell you, first of all, that I knew and have always known that there are good police officers, but there are some that, you know, unfortunately do not follow the law. And I have pride always myself in being a strong disciplinarian in holding people accountable. Yet, when I saw the text messages that came out in March of 2015 from 14 police officers in San Francisco, I was completely, completely taken by surprise. I would never have imagined that we still harbor those feelings in 2015 or 2012 when those messages were originally put out. And not only was I revolted by it, but it became very clear to me that aside from the racism and the problems that those text messages indicated, there was a real problem for me as a district attorney to do my work and be able to do it well, because we depend on police officers from providing testimony in order to do our work, and in order to do so, I needed to make sure that we got to the bottom of this. And I refused to believe at that point that this was simply 14 officers, because the way that they conducted their business was too casual, it was too normalized. And when we tried to get help in order to conduct that investigation, with, by the way, no one in the county was really looking to do beyond investigating those 14 officers, I've run into one wall after the other, and that was the beginning of putting this panel together that has done incredible work. And the second part of your question, what would I do differently today? Well, I tell you what I'm doing differently. I'm looking at the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon panel, and I'm ensuring that everything that we can do in my office to ensure that this type of behavior will not taint the work that we do in the future.
Okay, thank you. And let's move on to one of those recommendations and a question for Judge Cordell. And one of the key recommendations is for the San Francisco Police Department to have an inspector general. That sounds like a really good idea. Over the years, I've spoken with many inspectors generals, general who have come into their jobs feeling energized and excited about making a difference, you know, with the police department. And then after being there for a while, have talked about a lack of funding, not enough staffing, you know, insufficient access to the things they need to do their job. I'm wondering what your experience was like in San Jose and how you think things need to work here in San Francisco for this job to make a difference.
Thank you. And before I answer your question, I was struck by the fact that when Cruz Reynoso got up and said, "I'm Cruz Reynoso," there was a silence in the room. And I thought there's a lot of young people here who maybe don't know who this great man is. Cruz Reynoso was a justice on the California Supreme Court. He is a pioneer in fighting for civil rights. He is one of my heroes. And you all, it's really an honor to be in the presence of Cruz Reynoso. So just want to acknowledge. Thank you. With regard to our recommendation about having an inspector general's office, all of it goes to transparency in policing. So basically, the name of this program is, you know, policing the police. So where we are in this country is that we now understand that it is not acceptable for the police to police themselves. And by that we mean if there are complaints that are made about police conduct. Here, historically, the police have looked into those complaints and they've investigated themselves and then they've presented the findings without any kind of independent oversight. So what the Inspector General's office does is provide that independent civilian, and civilian means people like you and me who are not officers, having some oversight over how the police departments operate. There are 18,000 police departments in the United States, and most of them do not have independent civilian oversight. And those that do, I give them all the kudos in the world. There are different forms, however, of independent civilian oversight. One form is having an office of the Inspector General. So oversight means a couple of things. It means oversight over how complaints that are made by you against police, and also by police officers who generate complaints against their own within the department, having oversight over how those complaints are investigated and how the findings are made to make sure that those findings are objective. So in San Jose, where I was the independent police auditor, we didn't have an inspector general's office. We had a staff of six people, four of whom, when I started, were lawyers. And our purpose was really to have oversight over this complaint process. There's also other kinds of oversight. You can have it in the form of civilian review boards. And when you think about that, people get very excited. Yeah, civilians, we're going to look at everything. And I stress to you to look very carefully at those kinds of boards, because oftentimes they are not effective. One, because a lot of times they're volunteers and they have to get together and have a quorum to meet. They have to do it on their own time oftentimes, and then they have to have the time to conduct hearings or whatever it is they're designated to do. The proposal, the recommendation that we've made here for San Francisco is to have independent oversight over everything, over the operations of the police department. So, for example, looking at the system of discipline, is it being done in a thoughtful, objective fashion? Our officers, we call it an early warning system. Our officers who are generating complaints, are they flagged and talked to and counseled early on in the process? So having civilians kind of have oversight. We're not telling the police what to do, but we're certainly holding police departments accountable when there are independent individuals who are having oversight over the operations.
Oftentimes, controversial police shootings, you know, come down to someone being given that extra split second. when an officer is deciding whether he's going to pull the trigger or she's going to pull the trigger. I'm going to direct this question to Van Jones. In my years covering the LAPD and interviewing officers who had been in shooting after shooting, some of them 5, 7, 10 shootings, a lot of shootings, and people, you know, just officers in the department, they talked about, you know, it not being an issue of somebody being black or brown is the reason that they're being shot. And these are some black and brown officers who I'm talking to. But they're talking about the area in which they're policing and the level of anxiety and danger that they feel in one area versus another area in the city, and acknowledging that perhaps they are too quick to pull the trigger sometimes, but that there's a reason behind it. My first question is, do you buy that? And if you do, what are some, you know, out-of-the-box approaches for addressing that problem? I ask that of you because I know that you wear a lot of different hats and, you know, are a creative thinker in that way.
You asked if I buy that? No.
So the area where an officer works, in your view, is not going to...
You know, it's interesting. Beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and so is threat. I spent my early 20s, in a drug-infested den of crime and iniquity called Yale Law School. I've never seen so much felonious activity. Nobody went to jail. In fact, the police would drive past Yale to go 3 or 4 blocks down to the housing projects, where you had poorer kids doing fewer drugs. And they put all those kids in jail. If you create a black market, you enable cartels, you enable violent people. But they create black markets in some neighborhoods and they don't create it in others. If they created the same conditions in the suburbs where kids are doing every drug imaginable, they'd have some shootouts there too. They don't go there. So part of the situation is we have to have a more holistic approach. If you get all the way down to that last second where you're already freaked out and dealing with people you've never met and don't talk to and scared of, and every time you think about them you get frightened in that last split second, or you got to make a bad decision, you probably will. But how did we get in that situation in the first place? And by the way, being here for me is very difficult. April 6, 1996, 20 years ago, I was a young kid in this town. I used to sneak in to your services, Reverend Cecil. I would sneak in because I didn't have any money to put in the plate. And I would sit right up there in the corner and I'd cry and try to feel better, because the police in San Francisco were brutal then. April 6, 1996, Mark Garcia beaten, stomped, and pepper sprayed to death. I'm getting there. Beaten, stomped, and pepper sprayed to death right there in the Mission District. Lead arresting officer, then captain, sir. People marched then. People talked about accountability then. People talked about the need for more oversight then. And the young people of color in this city at that time, who had more wisdom and more insight about what was going on with the police then, were totally ignored. And that brutal police officer went from being a captain to being a chief. I wasn't surprised at all when a thug brute of a police officer and a murderer of a police officer, who got away with it 20 years ago, wound up being the chief of police that you had 1,000 problems. But the young people could have told you that then. May 13th, 1998, Sheila DeToy, you talk about people shooting. Sheila DeToy, 17-year-old girl. I'm over here 15 minutes from here, 10 minutes from here, sitting in a car with her boyfriend. Her boyfriend had a arrest warrant for a nonviolent drug offense. Gregory, Officer Gregory Breslin, nicknamed TikTok, known through the whole department as TikTok, runs up on the car in plain clothes, pulls his gun out. The kids panic, try to ski away. He fires one shot in front of the car, bullet goes over. He jumps to the side, fires one shot through the side. The kid driving the car hugs the steering wheel. The bullet goes by, hits Sheila DeToy, 17-year-old kid, in the head, blows her brains out all over the car. White girl in a car with a black kid. This kid never had an overdue library book, dead. Then he turns and fires at the car that's going behind and shoots another kid in the back. Everybody knows who the cops are that shoot too much. Everybody knows who the cops are who are trigger happy. They have nicknames like Mad Dog and TikTok and all these things. And everybody will then give them excuses for then putting themselves in harm's way and shooting their way out, as long as they do it in poor communities. My point is simply this. Nobody here hates police. If you think you hate the police, as soon as something happens, you call them anyway, so you don't really hate them. It's kind of like your ex-boyfriend. You kind of really hate him. But you got an orange creature from some other planet running for president talking about law and order. Now, my point is, nobody wants law and order more than people who live in communities that don't have it. Nobody wants law and order more than people who are living in communities where there are funerals for young people every other weekend. Nobody wants law and order more than we do. But I'm a radical. I have a very radical idea. The police should obey the law, too. The police should obey the law, too. That's law and order. That's law and order. So I'm going to let Kamal get in here, but I do want to say
no, you keep going, brother. You got it.
But I just want to say this. What the judge was saying is common sense. And it was common sense in the streets of San Francisco and in Oakland and Richmond 20 years ago when I was a young kid running around here protesting. You don't have to hate the police to want police reform. Nobody hates butchers, but you still want meat inspectors. You still want to make sure it's all right. Nobody hates architects and construction workers, but you still want building inspectors to make sure it's all right. Any system, any human system that doesn't have adequate checks and balances and oversight will tend toward corruption and abuse, period, point blank. That's just human nature. Nobody mad at nobody.
So since we don't have any active police officers on the stage, and we don't have the presence of the people who shared these observations about patrolling and, you know, the 77th Division in LA and encountering people with guns and so on, I think the question that they might ask if they were here is, did you encounter a lot of violent crime at Yale? Do you think that the police felt threatened there by the students who they encountered? Is that a fair comparison?
It is, and this is what I want people to understand. We create black markets in poor communities for drugs, for self-medication. We don't do it in the suburbs. In other words, where did the violence come from? Did people just wake up and they say, I want to be violent today? It's Tuesday. Let's just be violent. See, you have to have a racist view to imagine that black people just wake up and say, I must be violent today. You have to have an anti-poor view to believe that. Yes, there's an awful lot of violence, but where does it come from? Black markets. Listen, back during Prohibition, when they said nobody could have a beer, it was violent. People said, I want a beer. And because it was illegal, only very, very risk-taking people, often people who were prone to violence, were willing to provide those services. The reason that you don't see the shootouts in the suburbs is because the people can get the suburbs, and the suburbs can get the drugs without any incident. My problem is simply this. We have been militarizing law enforcement. Yeah, listen, you are correct, sir. If you are at the end of that long train and you are just some poor police officer sitting there in the car and you've created this entire war zone and you're sitting there trying to get home to see your wife and kids, you or I might shoot anybody in that insane situation. But we aren't having a conversation and shouldn't be only having a conversation about what some individual police officer does in some crazy situation. We should be having a conversation as a country about how can we do something in these communities besides just sending the police.
Thank you. So the person to my immediate left here.
I cede the rest of my time to Van, actually.
Not that easy. My person to the person to my immediate left here is sort of a self-described pioneer in this world of police and community relations, and I'll quote him on the topic. This is a quote from an episode of his program United Shades of America, in which he says, "I'm going where no other civilian black man has ever gone before. To the front seat of a police car."
I had to fight to get that line in, actually.
So tell us about that. Give us a little context, and share your observations about your time in Camden.
I can do that. First of all, I want to Azaria. Am I saying that correctly? Yeah. Thank you. You know, this is a real, and I know that people out there know this. I want to give it up for all my activists and organizers out there. You should be sitting in this seat. Thank you for showing up. I appreciate you doing the real work. And I will get to that in a second. But the question I thought this when I saw who was on the bill. I thought this this morning when I woke up and thought about this. Where are the police? Why aren't they? Shouldn't be a comedian seat. I think I got booked last week because they finally canceled last week. Where are the police? I think that the problem that I see is that if we can't get the police in the seat, we're like people at Thanksgiving talking about how grandma's a problem and grandma ain't there. Where are the police? I'm asking you. I feel like that it's a theoretical conversation at this point. It's not actually a real conversation about what we can do next, you know? And I know you worked hard, sister. Thank you for your work. Thank you. I know you did. And I know you tried to get him here. I want to be clear about that. But where are the police? I just think that we have created a thing here where the police feel like they're separate from the rest of us. And we've allowed the police to do that. We talk about the police community like it's separate from other communities. And police talk about our community versus the black community, and it's like there shouldn't be separate things. And so for me, it seems really indicative of where we are in this point in society and where we've always been, is that the police don't show up here because they don't feel accountable to the rest of us.
But the police were there in Camden, and so were you.
And I'll tell you about that, which is interesting. I know more cops from 4 days in Camden than I know from my 20 years of living in the Bay Area.
And your impressions?
I'll get there. Cops in Camden are doing a thing called community policing. How's it working? The results are mixed. People are talking about it. But the cops in Camden get out of their cars. They walk the beat. They meet people so that hopefully when the poo hits the fan, the cop knows who that person is, knows who's the poo thrower, all right? And that's what the whole point is in Camden, is that cops get out of their cars and meet people. And I really said, I live in Berkeley. Berkeley is what? 20, I don't know how many people it is, but it ain't that many. It's 15, 16 people. And I don't know the police. And I don't understand why we have to, this is the problem, is that until the police feel separate, so they stay in their cars, they don't talk to you unless there's a problem. And what it does is that, yes, as Van said, when you call, when you are in trouble, you call the cops. But I think a lot of people in this room call them like this. the same way you would call a mountain lion to the senior house if there was problems. And it, so, yes, in Camden, I did talk to cops. They are trying to do a thing, and I think that unless police departments, the police in Camden have taken it upon themselves to admit that they've made mistakes and change things. The first thing police departments have to do is that they have made mistakes. And it seems like because they're not here, they're not admitting they've made mistakes.
Another question for District Attorney Gascon. You spent much of your career at the LAPD, which is no stranger to scandal. From Rodney King to Rampart to any number of controversial police shootings. How did what you experienced there, not as a child that you talked about before, but you know, in your role as a police officer, influence you know where you are today? What did you learn from that? Do you see history repeating itself? At the time of Rodney King, you had MDT messages, and now you have text messages. What's changed?
You know, unfortunately, not much. And I hate to say that because it pains me greatly. As Scott indicated, I grew up in the LAPD, and, you know, I saw a lot of bad things happen, but I saw some really good evolution. And, you know, I think that, for instance, the federal consent decree that took place in L.A., it really made the organization turn around. And I believe that L.A., not perfect, but it's a much better place today than probably before the consent decree. But I tell you that what really disturbs me greatly is what I have seen in the last 2.5 years that is so graphic in terms of questionable uses of force by police, that before, frankly, people may say that a use of force was inappropriate, but you know, we had a tendency, quite frankly, to generally believe the story that was being given to us by the officers at the scene. And I think, by the way, the majority of the time, the stories are still are going to be accurate. But what we have seen in different parts of the country, and frankly, what we're seeing here in San Francisco today, should be a wake-up call to all of us. It's certainly a wake-up call to me. And I have to tell you that if we were having this conversation about 3 years ago, I would be in a very different place. I have to say that while I have been involved in law enforcement for the last 30 years, the last three and a half year have been a tremendous evolution for me. And I am at a place where I believe that we have a tremendous opportunity to turn things around. But we have to act. You know, when we have African-American parents talking to their young kids about how to behave around the police, before, for me, I have to tell you that often that was kind of a theoretical conversation. I understood the sensitivity, but I couldn't quite get my arms around it. And then all of a sudden, we have all seen some of the shootings that have occurred, including the one in Minnesota very recently, and all of a sudden the context and the meaning of that has taken a very different life. And frankly, the things that motivated me to bring LaDoris and to bring Cruz, who has been an inspiration for me since I was a young kid, you know, LaDoris is absolutely right. Cruz has been an inspiration, but especially for poor Latino kids that grew up in neighborhoods like the one that I did, looking at a Latino that was actually in the California Supreme Court, that was just an incredible inspirational moment for me. And to have him join LaDoris and Judge Trevisan from L.A. and coming together to do this work was very meaningful to me. And I have to tell you that I am completely committed to seeing this work to make sure that it goes through and that there is not only reform in the San Francisco Police Department, which I think is very important, but that we reform American policing in general.
I have a question for the judge. It requires a little bit of a wind-up. In 1996 or so, a young man by the name of Javier Francisco Ovando was sentenced to 26 years to life in prison for allegedly attacking police officers in Los Angeles with an assault weapon. the judge at the time said he was giving such a harsh sentence because Ovando had showed no remorse. As it turns out, Ovando was unarmed. The officers shot him, paralyzed him, planted a gun on him, and perjured themselves to send him to prison. That was the beginning of the Rampart scandal. A few days after this was disclosed, the DA's office went into court on their own writ and had this guy, Ovando, released from prison. It was the first time in the recent memory of the DA's office that they'd ever done such a thing. There would be 125 cases to follow where they did the same thing. Many of those people were convicted after confessing, and they turned out to be false confessions. And my question to you is, does that problem still exist? Do you see a problem with police officers, juries just tending to believe officers and not scrutinize them, false confessions due to the system being stacked against defendants, et cetera? Is that an issue we need to be paying attention to?
The answer is yes. Quite frankly, we have a racialized system of criminal justice. And let me just pick up on this whole false confession thing very quickly. There's something in the law called an Alford, A-L-F-O-R-D, plea. And it's based upon a case that was eventually decided by the United States Supreme Court, and the defendant's name was Mr. Alford. The United States Supreme Court in the Alford case established law, and here is the law. If you are charged with a crime and you didn't do the crime and you were offered a plea bargain, even if you didn't do the crime, the Alford case says you can plead, do an Alford plea, which says I plead guilty, but you also say at the same time, I didn't do it, but I don't want to take the risk of going to trial. Approximately 2% of criminal convictions come about by jury trials. Over 90% are by plea bargains. Many of them, Alford pleads, by people who don't want to spend any more time in jail waiting to go to trial, can't post bail, a variety of reasons. And yet our Supreme Court has sanctioned, given its approval, to saying to people, if you didn't do it, but you don't want to take the risk, it's legal, it's lawful, do an Alford plea. Plea bargains run the system. And who do you think takes plea bargains more than any other groups of people? Poor people, black and brown people. So that's just a little piece of the kinds of things that need to be fixed in the system. And let me just very quickly just say one last thing. It's really important to have conversations about policing and race, because conversations can change hearts and minds, and that's fine. But I think as importantly, or more importantly, these conversations should be about changing hearts, minds, and the law. We need to change laws. And here is something, a law that you can look at, and if you care enough about it, you can change, that will bring transparency to policing. With transparency, you get accountability. You get to know what they are doing, and with accountability comes trust. In California, there's a Police Officer's Bill of Rights. If you have never read it, read it. Google it. You go to the Government Code, Section 3300, and start reading. And the reason it's important, these laws were passed by our California legislature, and the result has been that there is very little sunshine in policing in California. And a very quick example, if you have an interaction with a police officer and you're not happy and you file a complaint, once that complaint is in the system and being investigated, you want to know, well, does this officer have had other kinds of complaints like this? The Police Officer's Bill of Rights says you can't know that. It's none of your business. If the officer is found to have engaged in bad conduct with you, it's likely the officer will then be disciplined. So you say, hey, I'm the victim in this. What was the discipline? The Bill of Rights says you can't know that. And the The law is now being interpreted to say, you know, we now have cell phones, the body-worn cameras for police officers, and everybody's hailing that as a big deal. It is, but it is as long as I believe there should be some access to the footage. So what have police officers... So the police unions, and it's not just San Francisco, San Jose and others, have basically said, guess what? Cell phone footage from body-worn cameras is deemed to be part of the officer's personnel file, and personnel files are confidential. So policing has expanded and broadened the definition of a personnel file to include body camera, worn camera footage. That means if you are the subject of a complaint and you want to see the footage because you are now the subject of it, you can't see it. Police officer's Bill of Rights. So it's important to change hearts and minds, but we need to change some laws.
A good spot for a very brief reminder to our radio audience. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking about reforming American law enforcement with San Francisco District Attorney George Gascon, Judge Ladoris Cordell, Blue Ribbon panel member, Van Jones, CNN commentator and political activist, W. Kamau Bell, host of CNN show United Shades of America. I'm your moderator, Scott Glover, an investigative journalist and justice reporter for CNN. Now, let's take a question from the audience. This question, I believe the issue probably varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but it says, why is it not required for civil servants, such as police, to live in the city, community, county they serve? And then parenthetically, Kamau talked about this on his TV show.
Who can afford to live in San Francisco?
Shouldn't, and I understand what you're saying, but shouldn't subsidized housing for police? Can't believe I just said that. Doesn't it help policing? This is what I found out. I'm sure. Doesn't it generally help policing if they live in the community that they're policing? So shouldn't it be, you know, shouldn't we put like, you know, like projects for police? Okay, so scattered housing. Scattered housing. Is that better?
Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question, and I think people imagine that that might work because maybe if people lived together, they would understand each other, and they would be kind to each other. You know, but there are people who live in houses with each other and are violent. So the idea that somehow if just somebody lived in the neighborhood, they wouldn't be violent. I grew up in a neighborhood where there were plenty of people who were violent, and they weren't cops. So for me, I think that we just don't want to deal with the real issue. There are two real issues. Cops got to live someplace, false issue. Better training, false issue. The better training makes no difference if when you violate the training and nothing happens to you, then why are we doing the training? And part of what happens with that is you got, you know, a good cop, a middle cop, and a terrible cop. They all get trained to be good cops. The terrible cop acts a fool, and nothing happens. So then the middle cop figures out pretty quickly there's no point in trying to be a good cop because there's no consequences. So the key issue here is consequences. There has to be, listen, if you violate the rules on your job, you get disciplined, demoted, or fired. If you work at Baskin and Robbins, there's no Baskin and Robbins Bill of Rights for you. You just get your butt fired. So the idea that only one group of people have their own Bill of Rights by itself lets you know we are far, far off track. If you can't be disciplined, demoted, fired, prosecuted, incarcerated, you're going to start acting terrible. Even you. You say, not me. Yeah, you. After a year, 3 years, 5 years, nobody around you gets in trouble no matter what they do. You create a whole culture of corruption, and that's happening across the country. I come from a law enforcement family. My father was a police officer in the military. My favorite uncle just retired, thank God, safely from the Memphis City Police Force. I never grew up seeing police as saints and superheroes. I saw them as city employees like everybody else, some good, some bad, some smart, some stupid. And yet, they all have this presumption of godhood. a jury, if a police report said that I ran after the subject and I pulled them down to the ground and I looked up into the purple sky, the jury would say, the sky was purple. It was in the police report. Jurors think that the police report is written by Moses. They just, if it's written in the police report, no matter how absurd or ridiculous, this is a major problem. So,
how do you change that?
I'm getting somewhere. Hold on a second. So, I got to describe the problem first.
Well, I think we get it. And
I'm getting someplace. And now it'll take even longer. So look, the problem that we have is that because this, nobody understands that if a police officer shoots somebody, they don't write the police report. Their lawyer writes the police report. They have a they cannot incriminate themselves. They can't be made to incriminate themselves. So police officers, SFPOA, Police Officers Association lawyers write the police report for every one of these things. Nobody knows that. You don't know that, and you live in San Francisco, and you're liberal. So what we've got to be able to do, first of all, is fight for real accountability. And then the last thing I want, and at least inform jurors that this police report was not written by this dude, it was written by the guy over there. And the last thing I want to say is this. We got to deal with accountability on the back end. Put people who break the law in jail, no matter what color uniform they wear, number one. And then number two, we also have to deal with on the front end. The hiring is totally crazy in the United States. We have 18,000 police departments. There's no federal standard that says you can't hire sociopaths. You can't hire psychopaths. You can't hire people with extreme bias. And people are now saying that sociopathy, extreme narcissism, no empathy, which is about 7% of the normal population, may be as high as 30% in some law enforcement agencies. So you're hiring crazy cowboy cops and then telling me if they live in my neighborhood and they have happy training, they're going to be better? No. Don't hire crazy people and fire them when they kill people.
I think the district attorney and perhaps the judge might like to weigh in on some of Van's commentary.
No, I agree that it's about accountability. You can have all the training in the world, and unless there's some accountability behind the training, you're going to continue to have problems. One of the things that we saw as the Blue Ribbon Panel work looking at the San Francisco Police Department was, for the last 5 years, how little discipline was provided to people that engage in really questionable conduct. So that sends a message to everybody else. I think also when it comes to use of force, and to Judge Cordell's point, we really need to begin to look at the law. You know, one of the problems, especially when it comes to police use of force, is that we have a structure that was created by the U.S. Supreme Court that is called a reasonable officer standard. And the problem with that standard is it has been interpreted and has been stretched to such a point that when an officer under this objective reasonable officer standard feels that he or she is somehow threatened, no matter how removed the threat might be, or anyone else in the officer's opinion, the officer has a tool bag that is really very broad. They can go anywhere from saying, hey, stop doing that, to using their firearm. And the problem from a criminal prosecution point of view is that it becomes extremely difficult for the law and certainly for prosecutors to deal with this problem. There has to be an evolution of that. We really need to get to a point where we're talking about the minimum use of force because we have to ensure that you don't get to use force because you can't. You use force because you need to, because you have to, in order to protect life. And we're not a situation where, unfortunately, in American policing, you can use force because you can. And that is a major problem. So I think that you have to do two things. Number one is accountability is very important. And certainly with my time on the job, I can tell you that when you have good discipline systems, good police officers benefit from that. It creates transparency. It creates a better level of communications with the people that they're policing, and it sends a good example across the board within the organization. And secondly, we need to look at the rules of the game, and when it comes to police use of force, we really need to evolve and we need to go somewhere else.
If I can break in for just a moment, I have some actual breaking news. The police are, in fact, here. I am going to introduce some folks. Please forgive me if I mispronounce your name or your title. It's coming from a card here, but I understand that Deputy Police Chief Makali Ali, Captain Jason Chernis, Commissioner Victor Huang are here in the audience and okay with being introduced. Please welcome them. And I would encourage any or all of you guys to make your views known, to join us on the stage, to get a microphone. If you want to address anything that's being said here, please do. Please introduce yourself and tell folks what's on your mind.
Well, first of all, obviously I didn't prepare for this, but my name is Mikhail Ali. I'm one of several police officers who are here. I'm a deputy chief of police. I've been a part of the San Francisco Police Department now going into my 25th year. And I'm here on my own time, as is every other officer who's here, simply because we wanted to hear what the community has to say. And right, wrong, on point, off point, we have a responsibility to listen and to address those concerns. And so that is precisely why I'm here, and the others are here as well.
Do you want to address any of the concerns that Van was raising regarding the writing of reports and...
I just remember Van on Market Street in about 10th or 11th, many, many years ago. So,
while I have an officer here on the stage, let me pose this question to the entire panel, any or all of you. Is it possible that we're simply seeing more of a problem that's happening less frequently? As I mentioned, I worked on a big project at the LA Times. We looked at 1,437 officer-involved shootings from 1985 through 2004. I read every single report, as did my reporting partner, Matt Late. And we put them into three-ring binders. In some years, they were well into the triple digits. In some years, you needed two binders. There were a whole lot of police shootings in the late 80s and early 90s. There were a whole lot of dead black men, a whole lot of them unarmed. I don't recall any of them being caught on cell phone footage. I don't know when cell phones really, you know, became so prevalent, but there's Rodney King, but you know, it wasn't really an issue in all of these reports that we're looking at. So I pose this question, not to diminish any of what's happening or any of the individual cases that are so sad and tragic, but is it possible that we're just seeing it more?
I think we are. I believe that when we start unfolding and unpacking what is going on, I think that we are seeing more. And I think that even for many of us that have spent an entire life in law enforcement, certainly adult life, I think it's an eye-opening for many of us. I can tell you that I don't believe that all of a sudden we have a new generation of police officers who somehow have become more violent or less respectful of the law. I have to regretfully say that a lot of the complaints that before I would look at them and we investigate them, and quite frankly, because it was the word of one person against another, we basically determined that we had no resolution to the case. I think that now we're seeing a very different face to policing. And I say this, and I want to underline again, that I still continue to believe that the majority of the men and women in uniform work very hard under very difficult conditions, and they're doing the right things day in and day out. But what we're seeing now is a the opening of a window into policing and American policing that we didn't see before. And I think that is something that have been going there all the time. And I know that if you talk to anyone in the African-American community, they would tell you, you know, we have been telling you this for the last 100 years or whatever. And I get that. And that's why I'm here today and what we're doing, the kind of work that we're doing. But I don't think it's any different today than it was probably years ago. And Mikhail, I don't know what your thoughts are on.
I want to say there's a couple of things that are happening. One is, you know, there's just more footage of it. So it's true. You can see more of it. And then when you have people who can do Facebook Live and really pull you into their car, pull the entire world into the car when it's happening, that's going to have a more emotional impact. But I think the thing that quietly bothers people more than even the incident, it's watching other police officers not react the way that the rest of the world is reacting. That's much more terrifying. I might be the worst police officer in the world, but if I pull my gun out and I shoot somebody, or I'm beating somebody and I'm calling them all kind of names, this officer should arrest me. This officer should say something. This officer, when I write my police report and I say, well, this person was doing X, Y, and Z, this officer should write a report that says, no, he's lying. It's when that doesn't happen that we get terrified, because you realize how systemic it is. That's the problem.
Judge, I think you wanted to say something, Judge, before I introduce the deputy chief. You're okay? Okay. And again, while I've got the deputy chief here on the stage, just unless you have something to say now, I have something I'd like to. Okay. So one more with a little bit of wind-up. When I was working on the shooting project, I did a lot of, you know, simulators with the LAPD and the FBI and so on, shoot, don't shoot, et cetera. You know, obviously, that you can't really know what it's like, but they do a pretty good job of making you decide. One thing, this is an embarrassing story, but just to let you know, a small taste of the dangers of being an officer. I actually injured myself in a shooting simulation with the FBI. I got the web of my hand caught in the slide of a 9mm and actually bled. I think the agents loved it. But I got a bit better at it as I, you know, did it repeated times. And I was doing it at the LAPD and had quite an advantage, having read, you know, more than 1,000 police reports about what to do in certain situations. And so the instructor leads me through the thing, and I do quite well. It's in an office building where there's a gunman. He comes in. He's got people hostages and everything. And I basically am able to shoot the gunman several times, and I don't hit any of the people who run in front of you and they try to get you to shoot. So the instructor comes out. He's probably retired by now. He's an old school guy. And he goes, okay, what do you got? You know, like, I'm the cop and I've got to break it down. And I said, well, I came in. You know, I saw a threat. I started shooting, and I stopped shooting when the threat was ended. Well, how many shots did you fire? I'm not sure. You know, well, that's not going to cut it. You need to know how many shots you fired. You need to justify, you know, 1 through 7. You need to articulate clearly what precisely happened, et cetera. And this is a conversation that stayed with me for a long time. And I think you probably see where I'm going with it, which is, you know, do you create a culture where you have to have all the answers because there's this fear, which I think, by the way, is unjustified, about being seriously disciplined or prosecuted for an honest mistake shooting? Is this where sometimes, when you see these big civil payouts and these bad facts that emerge in civil court, is that where that comes from? Is there that kind of pressure when you're a cop?
You know, it's interesting. That approach to training is a bit dated, actually. And the reality is, and it's dated from the context that it's not best practice. That's not to say that it doesn't exist, because in some cases it still does. When you present an officer with only two choices of shoot or don't shoot, you've eliminated other options and other avenues of dealing with that problem. And it comes from a very false pretense to begin with. There, in dealing with people and dealing with circumstances, there are a multitude of options to mitigate a problem. But if you're in training, you're only saying your only options are either to shoot or not to shoot. 50% of the chance of time you're going to get it right. And that ends in tragedy. And so, you know, we're training away from that. When we We actually have changed the name of our simulator to Force Options Simulator, as opposed to Shoot, Don't Shoot. So to let you know from the very beginning, this may not be a shooting scenario. You may not have to use your firearm. You may simply use verbal persuasion to bring this to an end. But, you know, this is also supplemented by a mindset that is also very passe, and that is a mindset that the world and the community is out there to get you. It puts the officers on edge. They go into the community fearful. You know, they're looking for the boogeyman, and any indicator of the boogeyman may tend to cause them to overreact. And so from the standpoint of educating our officers and leading our officers, you know, the mindset of, you know, I'd rather be judged by 12 than carried by 6, that's something that has to go. It has to completely go. We have to make certain that our officers are not walking into scenarios fearful, recognizing the danger, but not fearful of every single scenario. I mean, fearful that a person who's 5'1" with a pair of scissors, you know, down by their waist, is capable of doing something, causing you to shoot at that person a multitude of times. That's the kind of mentality that brings those kind situations to existence.
Honest question. I ask my dad and my uncles this all the time. Why don't the good cops arrest the bad cops? Because every, just like at your job, you know who the idiots are. Just like at your job, you know who the terrible people are. On the police force, you already know who the ones are.
Sure.
Why don't you arrest them and do something about it?
Well, let me tell you. So I've had many situations where I'm there with an officer, or maybe even I've even having a bad day, and I'm not connecting with Van Jones today because Van has gotten underneath my skin. And my partner, he recognizes that, and they intervene. And so they prevent something from escalating to something something bad. And that happens all the time.
And I'm going to say that, again, there are good officers that do report other officers. You know, my office certainly is prosecuting several cases that all come from police personnel reporting others. And I have to tell you that in my prior life in the LAPD also, we prosecuted officers. So,
okay,
you know,
please let us finish.
It does occur. Perhaps it needs to be more, there needs to be more accountability, but it's not completely unheard of.
Okay. I have a question here for the Deputy Chief. Thanks very much, again, for joining us on the stage. We do appreciate it. It's become a way too common scenario. There's cell phone footage of a controversial police shooting. It looks bad, you know, to the layman. The police response is the video doesn't tell the whole story. Often the police response is the video doesn't tell the whole story. We have to, you know, wait for our investigation before we can really comment. And, you know, that's frustrating, I think, for everybody involved, both the police side and the people who are upset about the shooting. And I think it's viewed with skepticism by some. That said, often these instances become symbols of police abuse, with no police comment, no explanation. Is that fair? What are your thoughts on this? You know, what do you have to say about that topic?
You know, I completely understand the community's frustration with that process, but it is a process. And the unfortunate thing is it's become a very lengthy process, and there is their opportunity to make some changes. As a police executive, if I have a part of an investigation of officers involved under my watch where there's not maybe clear criminal culpability on their part, then I have to be silent to some degree and allow that investigation to play its course and not speak on evidence that ultimately may taint the outcome of that investigation. The challenge is we need to make those investigations move quicker. They need to be objective. I completely agree that across this country, we need not necessarily investigate our own set of circumstances when an officer is involved in a shooting, but perhaps, you know, a state or a federal agency or another law enforcement partner actually come in and be the objective eyes doing the investigation particularly when you're dealing with officer misconduct.
You know, can I just say that, you know, we're hearing some comments from people who are not satisfied. They're not happy. And I will tell you, it's all comes about because there's no trust in the process, and there's no trust in the process because it's all closed up. We don't know how it works. If you want us to believe in you, then we have to believe you. And if I can't believe you unless I know what is happening, how things are going. So let me give an example. Judges, doctors, psychologists, if any of us have complaints and they are sustained, and that means we are disciplined, any member of the public can find out. You can go online, go to the state bar, and you can find out if your lawyer has ever been disciplined, what the discipline was, and what the facts were about the case that led to it. But you can't do that with police. And again, we're back to police officers' bill of rights, the laws, right? And why a particular group is so sealed off. And I maintain that it works to the disadvantage of police because everything is so secret, we can't trust completely. That has to change.
First off, I'd like to thank the audience for all of the questions that you've been submitting. Many of them have been asked. Many are overlapping. We're getting close to an end here. I'm going to ask one specific question for our deputy chief, which is, how many hours of de-escalation training do officers in SF get as a percentage of all training and compared to other cities?
I obviously don't have that information, but what I do have is this. Every San Francisco police officer in the San Francisco Police Academy, and I know this because I made it happen, receive almost 120 hours of crisis intervention training, de-escalation training, while they're in the academy. That started in June of last year. I'd say at this point, well over 50% of our patrol force has had an upwards of 80 to 120 hours of training relative to dealing with people in crisis, to learning ways of de-escalating situations that obviously can get out of hand. And in most instances, we get it right. I'm sorry, ma'am. I don't think you heard me. I said that each recruit receives about 120 hours while in the academy, and every officer has received that as well. We started with 40 hours of what we call pre-crisis intervention training. We started that training about 5 years ago. 4 years ago, actually 3 years ago, we transitioned working with the mental health community in San Francisco, where well over 50% of our force is now trained in crisis intervention training, which translates very simply into anyone who is not necessarily in their right frame of mind. And that could be any one of us on any given day. So that's the type of training that our people are receiving.
I was in Dallas, following the recent slayings of the officers there, and had what I considered an extraordinary conversation with a couple of African-American officers. And it was extraordinary in that you rarely hear police publicly criticize the actions of other officers and this sort of thing. And here was an instance where, you know, several brother officers were being buried, and these officers were talking about, you know, though the suspect was in no way justified for what he did, and, you know, while they grieved for their fallen colleagues and their families, et cetera, that they were saying that it was a moment that had to be seized to talk about the issues that the person, the suspect, said propelled him. And I thought that was just extraordinary. But in our conversation, they said, you know, we need to do this because every time one of these controversial shootings happens, you know, there's hand-wringing, there's blue ribbon panels, there's vows, you know, of we're going to change, we're going to do better. And I said, you know, well, how are you going to make it different this time? And you know, they didn't have much of an answer. And so I will pose that question to this panel. How is this going to be different?
Well, I can tell you one thing. I'm hoping that our elected officials take this the 81 recommendations that were made by this panel, which, by the way, are very specific. They're not, they're supported by the evidence of this report, and that we get to the business of implementing this. San Francisco now has a blueprint to really make a difference. Now, is it going to cure all the problems? No, but this is a really good beginning. And I'm hoping, by the way, that this is something that also other jurisdictions would take a look at it. The work that this three judges and the seven law firms and this five law schools put together, which were thousands of hours, is based on facts, is based on a real investigation, and the road to fixing some of the problems are there. Now, I'm going to tell you that certainly I'm going to work very hard to ensure that that happens in this community, and I'll definitely be walking around other places that want to hear about this issue because I think it's very important. I don't think we can walk away from it.
Three things. One, nationally, we have Representative Barbara Lee's office here. Give Barbara Lee a hand. Her office is here. I think there should, at the federal level, I think it should be non-controversial and bipartisan to say that if the federal government is going to be giving money to law enforcement agencies, be they local, state, or tribal, there should be a better screen on the front end in terms of hiring. That we shouldn't be hiring people who have, I'm about to get to you. So, you're my third point. But I do think it's important that we start raising the bar on the, if we hire better, we'll have to fire less. I think that the federal government should work harder and support police departments that are trying to do a better job on hiring and screening. I think that should be non-controversial. Number two, it's going to take elected officials, especially people like we have in Brother Gascon. This is an amazing, amazing man that is sitting here up on this stage to be a former police officer, to be a prosecutor, and who's trying to actually make sure that everybody's following the law, including the police. That's amazing. That's extraordinary, and that needs to become more common. It just needs to become more common. But the third thing is simply this. Community folks have a lot more power than we use. What Kamau did changed the whole dynamic. Kamau actually was more committed to this community having some healing and having some answers than him having a microphone. Now, that kind of leadership from community folks and from people who have big platforms is also going to be important. I think that we need a lot better from the federal government. We need a lot better from our local leaders. But frankly, we need a lot better from us. And I want to give the Brother Kamau a round of applause for changing this whole thing. That's beautiful, bro. Beautiful.
Please, Judge.
So I have two takeaways. One is that the Police Officers' Bill of Rights should be changed, and if it isn't done by legislators who are going to need the courage to deal with the police unions, then it should be done by an initiative of the people. We need to get that law changed and made open. And second, I think, and I know this, we need more people of color and women in police uniforms. Right? So I hope we will encourage our young people, women. By the way, studies have shown that when women are on police forces, that they use less violence, they engage in fewer shootings, and they are considerably, they do not use excessive force at anywhere the level that their male counterparts do, that they are a calming influence in the police forces. So those are two takeaways. We need the initiative by the people and get our young people more interested in becoming police officers.
You know, as I reflect on your story of the Dallas officers as they bury their own, having at least an appreciation for what was being said on the part of the suspect, and I will offer that there is a dichotomy of feelings, if you will, being a person of color in our criminal justice system. I am very aware. I'm a learned person. I understand the history of this system, and it's not been kind to people of color. And, having, the desire to change it to some degree or another, I became a police officer. And as the judge has said, I mean, if you're going to see a change in this system, you've got to be a part of it. You can't sit on the sideline and expect to win the game. It's just not going to happen. At the end of the day, what we're talking about is leadership. We're talking leadership in our police departments, leadership in our city government, leadership in our community. That is what's going to make a difference. I'll share this fact with you, because I think it's so very important. The average police chief in the state of California serves between 2 and 3 years. We've over-politicized the leadership position of our law enforcement entities throughout this state. I can only imagine what it is the rest of the country. You cannot run an organization on a 2 to 3 year period of time. You've somehow have got to put stop gaps in so that the politics do not continuously cause a change in leadership. You have to have some stability, and then you hold that person accountable based upon information that they have to provide. And it's just that simple. There is no other way around it. The attitude of the organization reflects the leadership of the leader.
I got my mic back. I can't be restrained, Van. As I got ready for this today, yesterday I started to do some research and Google some things and look some things up as I do. I didn't read the whole report. That was long. But I read an article, and I got a quote from the head of the union, Martin Halloran, about the police panel, about the Blue Ribbon Pill. Gascon organized this whole charade to publicize his inflammatory claims of widespread racism in the police department, when in fact the problem is much more limited in scope. This panel is nothing more than a kangaroo court orchestrated by Gascon and the three puppets he handpicked. So first of all, what we do is get a new head for the police union, I think is the first thing we need to do. I honor the work you did, and I appreciate the work you did, but until these so-called good cops that I've been hearing so much about tonight, like yourself, sir, step up and take these leadership positions and change the thing from the inside out, I feel bad. Everybody here, San Francisco residents going home, many of these people are going back to the thing that we're talking about theoretically. So and will be going to their neighborhoods, not knowing what's going to happen, and tomorrow if something bad happens, they might be as afraid to call a cop as they were before they got here tonight. And so until the good cops, and I've had cops in my family, rise up and take control of the police department, and therefore more cops like you show up at these things, we're in trouble. So I encourage good cops like you, sir, to step up and take leadership away from the so-called bad apples.
Okay. Well, I'd like to give a thank you to each one of our panel members, George Gascon, San Francisco District Attorney, Judge Ladoris Cordell, Judge Cruz Reynoso, both members of the Blue Ribbon Panel that investigated the San Francisco Police Department, W. Kamau Bell, host of the new CNN show, United Shades of America, Van Jones, CNN commentator and social justice activist, Youth Speaks poet Azaria Cole Shepherd, and last but not least, Deputy Police Chief Makali Ali. We are very grateful to the GLIDE community for hosting us and all the amazing work they do in San Francisco, and to GLIDE Center for Social Justice for partnering with us on producing this program. I'm Scott Glover. On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California and GLIDE Memorial Church here in San Francisco, thank you all for participating in this community conversation.